Odds were gone, but his helmet was still attached to his head and had probably helped save his life. His first-line gear was still attached to his body, which meant he had his pistol and blades. Without a working light to check his sniper rifle, he used his fingers to explore the familiar weapons system. Barrel, scope, stock, sling. Everything was in place. Whether it retained its zero remained to be seen. Gazing up at the mountains, he pulled out a small compass to get his bearings. He was alone, in enemy territory, without a working radio, and needed to rendezvous with his team. Their loss of comms link-up point was just a mile to the southeast. There was no sign of any other human life. He was alive and had a mission to complete. Alone, in a foreign land, he moved off into the night. I am never out of the fight. Chapter 72. Medny Island, Russia. Captain Karyavin Vasilyevich joined his men on the high ground and checked their position, arranged overlooking a choke point along the most likely avenue of approach to Deputy Director Alexander Zharkov's lodge. He'd shut down the tactical EMP and patrolled to the ambush site with his seven-man team, all combat veterans of Russia's forays into its former territories over the past decade. It would take 20 minutes for the EMP to rejuvenate and store enough power for another shot, but by that time, the Americans would be on the ground wondering why their high-tech gear was fried. They needed that deadly advantage over the Americans, whose technological superiority would now be reduced to useless pieces of wires and metal. The United States had outpaced their old adversary in technological advances since the fall of the Soviet Union. The new Russian Federation could stamp out machine parts and build the ever-reliable AK, but when it came to the weapons of the information age, computers and microchips, Russia was not even in the running. That meant they had to focus on how to eliminate the technological advantages of their enemies. Though export restricted, the nods and lasers that adorned the team's M4s were purchased in the United States, legally, by Alexander Zharkov's illegals. They were then dismantled and smuggled into Russia, using the deputy director's Bratva network to supply his private security detail with the best weapons and optics available. Night vision tubes were disguised inside binoculars, and M4s were disassembled and disguised as machine parts, then reassembled once safely inside the borders of Mother Russia. The one sniper in the group cradled a Chukovin rifle chambered in 7.62 by 54R in his arms. A recent replacement for the revered Cold War-era Dragunov, he knew the Schmittenbender optic that graced its top rail was not what soldiers in the Russian military would be using. The expensive scopes were for demonstrations and show purposes. True to form, the bureaucrats would ensure that the ground pounders would be given suboptimal glass so that more of them could be fielded. What was it Stalin had said about quantity? No matter. He had his rifle, scope, and a U.S.-made forward-mounted night optic along with an IR laser. He would have preferred the Orsis T-5000 Tokhnost in 338 Lapua, but that could not be helped. He'd send more than a few insurgents to their graves in Chechnya and Dagestan from behind the iconic-looking Dragunov, though having spent so much time with it, he knew the effective range only extended that of the AK by 300 meters. This new Kalashnikov-concerned Chukovin was different. With it, he'd kill his first American. Vasilyevich's men had emplaced MON-50 anti-personnel devices just minutes earlier on what amounted to the choke point at the most likely avenue of approach to the lodge. Though the men had no personal experience with the American Claymore mine, they knew the MON-50 was their country's equivalent and had seen their devastating effectiveness in combat in Chechnya and the North Caucasus. His former soldiers knew their trade. Most important, they possessed the element of surprise and had taken away the technological advantages of their opposition. Anyone the explosives didn't eviscerate, would be systematically gunned down by his team. Now it was time to watch and wait. Alexander was awake at 3 o'clock a.m., admiring the falling snow. The Buran snowmobile was gassed up and was idling next to the Kamaz 6x6 in the detached garage. Sergei's new dogs were not yet at the level of the two the Hastings woman had killed, though they were showing promising attributes. He'd shunned alcohol at dinner, as was his custom the night before a hunt, but still hadn't slept well. The anticipation overpowered his need for sleep. That worried him some. He wanted to be at his best. The team coming to kill him would be slaughtered on their approach, thanks to the intelligence from Grant LaRue and his lackey in the executive branch. The lobbyists lived and operated in plain sight, right under the noses of the Americans. The lobbying industry had been ripe for exploitation by the SVR. "What to do with the bodies?" As the National Deputy Director of Clandestine Services, he could turn this into a major international incident and push the United States and Russia to the brink of war. But what good would that do? There was a smarter, back-channel move to make.
"Later. Focus on the hunt."
He'd hoped to somehow capture Commander Reese alive, but the odds of capturing any of the American force alive were slim. He might make an even more formidable adversary than his friend who waited one floor below, nourished but cold and, more important, inspired. His sister's head in a formaldehyde jar to keep him company all night should have given him all the incentive needed to make this Alexander's most challenging and pleasurable adventure to date. It was time to hunt. Chapter 73. Medny Island, Russia. Everyone else on the team felt like they were back in the Dark Ages. Everyone but Reese. He was in his element. He'd grown up in the mountains with his father, who passed along the importance of map and compass work, terrain association, taking bearings, and triangulation. Their GPS devices, lasers, and nods might be down, but that didn't mean that these warriors were out of the fight. They reconsolidated at the link-up point. Reese was the last to arrive, the others having managed to land in the same general vicinity. Being most familiar with the routes and objective, Reese took dual point with Devon and Ido. The Belgian Malinois was off-leash and alert, back doing what he'd been trained for. Much like the men he accompanied, Ido had been out of the fight too long and was ready for action. Eli and Farkas followed, with Chavez taking rear security. The lack of nods meant they had to patrol closer together than they were accustomed to. They all knew the threat of being too close if a rocket, mortar, or IED hit. They hadn't jumped snowshoes. Intel suggested the snow covering was light. But reality on the ground was different than it looked from satellites 100 miles up. Even enveloped by darkness over the snow-covered ground, the team moved with purpose toward their objective. Their plan was to hit the lodge, grab Hannah and Rafe, make it to extract, and kill anyone who got in their way. Reese knew it was a bit harebrained. If he were still a SEAL, there was no way he would greenlight 5 assaulters and a dog hitting a lodge on an island off the coast of Siberia. He also knew that if the situation were reversed, Rafe would move heaven and earth to get him out. They were committed. They were going in. Devon froze. He raised his left hand in a fist at head level. He gave Ido the command to halt. "Bliff," he hissed in Dutch, following it with an immediate, "Here." Ido returned to Devon's left side, going prone on the snow, waiting for the next command. Devon had noticed the dog's body language change. It was something only those in tune with their partner would sense. His ears moved forward, his gait became more aggressive, and his tail changed its rhythmic wag ever so slightly. His next move would have been to finish or find the IED. Ito had not forgotten the ways of war. Neither had Devon. He did not want his dog to finish, which meant sitting right at the IED. Certain death. The team sank to their knees.
"Explosives ahead,"
Devon said under his breath.
"Are you sure?"
Reese asked, already knowing the answer.
"Positive," Ito alerted on it. "Lucky we were coming in from downwind, or we might have walked right past it."
"How far?"
"Hard to tell exactly, but in these conditions, 50 to 100 yards.
Ito's head snapped up again, ears erect, body stiff and ready to launch, looking ahead at an angle.
"Ambush,"
Devon declared. Reese was squinting into the darkness when the first round took him square in the chest. Chapter 74. Devon hit the ground and sent 10 rounds in the direction of the ambush before yelling, "Contact front!" "Plots!" he yelled at Ito over the sound of his rifle, ensuring Ito would stay down and by his side. "Online!" Eli low crawled toward Reese, Devon, and Ito, elbows sinking into the snow, digging in with his knees and feet to propel himself forward. In the darkness, they didn't have targets, and he'd only caught the slightest hint of a muzzle flash as he hit the deck moments earlier.
Suppressors.
Firing from their aggressors ceased. They had been on a slight incline, and the fact that they weren't all dead meant that Ito had kept them out of the kill zone. If they stayed down, they were below the enemy's line of sight, meaning they were endefilade.
"Win the fight," Eli thought. "Hard to do with nothing to shoot at."
Farkas was by his side in an instant. They grabbed Reese by his pant leg and began dragging him back toward a rock formation protruding from the snow behind. Devon pushed himself back, close behind, Ito low crawling right along with him toward their rear security.
"I have an out," he whispered, guiding the rest of the team to the rock behind him.
Devon and Farkas helped form a perimeter around their wounded leader as Eli went to work assessing his patient, running his hands up and down Reese's body, feeling for severe bleeding and massive injuries. As he went to check for breathing, Reese's eyes opened wide.
"I'm okay. I'm okay," he said, coughing. "Quiet, brother,"
Eli responded.
"You just took a round to the chest. Must have hit your head when you fell."
Reese's hand went to his chest and felt the pieces of ceramic plate that had split into fragments, absorbing the bullet's impact just as it was designed.
"Well, this thing is useless now,"
Reese observed, struggling out of his plate carrier and tossing his magazines to Eli.
"Where's my rifle?"
"Here you go, boss,"
Devon said. He'd grabbed the Eccles Legend on his crawl back to the rock.
"Thanks. Okay, what do we have?"
"Shooting stopped right after you were hit. Looks like they were set up with IEDs, mines, or an anti-personnel explosive device of some sort. We must be out of their line of sight here, but I'd wager they are maneuvering on us right now."
"That shot that took you was accurate. I'd guess they have NODs and suppressors, possibly IR lasers."
"Shit."
Devon turned in toward the former SEAL commander.
"Ito will let us know when they're coming."
Rafe and Hannah were to the west. Extract was a few hours out to the east. They were pinned down on an enemy island where their adversary held the technical and tactical advantages.
"Think, Reese.
Take a breath, look around, make a call."
He looked at the men around him. They were all there to help Rafe and Hannah, but they wouldn't have put their lives on the line unless Reese had asked. He looked back at the rifle in his hands. Wood stock. Night Force optic, similar to what his father had used in Vietnam, only more accurate.
That was it.
Vietnam.
"Bring it in,"
Reese whispered, the others scooting in closer so they could hear the combat-tested leader.
"Do you still have your flare guns? The ones we were to use in a loss of comms emergency extract to signal the bird?"
Heads nodded around the circle.
"Okay, then. We are going to take their advantage and even things up. The Vietnam guys who taught me had to fight at night without night vision. They had to turn night into day. We're going to do the same thing, but we have to do it fast." Hands were already going into kits and removing the small nautical flare guns Thorne had given them before they departed. It's not like the 40-millimeter flares we had in the teams, but it's all we have. I'm going to move to high ground just north, that hill we passed a couple hundred yards back. If my map study is correct, it should put me in a position slightly above theirs. If they flank us or start coming in, let the dog go and start putting up those flares and engaging. If I can get to high ground, I'll fire my flare and start putting them down. Time it right. We only have about 5 seconds per flare, so this is going to happen fast. How many flares per gun?
2,
Eli answered. Okay. I'll initiate with one of mine. As one flare goes out, put up another. Do not put two up at the same time. It's going to be close as it is. If they are moving in on us, we will have them in an L ambush.
Let me come with you, Eli pleaded.
Negative, you stay here. I need 3 of you on the guns and 1 of you putting up those flares. Besides, I work better alone these days.
Reese looked around the circle, and though they couldn't see it, he smiled. He was a sniper, and he was going to high ground. Chapter 75. Reese pushed himself forward at a full sprint, no small feat over snow-covered ground in the dark. He hadn't been shot in the back yet, which meant the enemy couldn't see him. An even darker shape appeared out of the darkness. The hill was just to his left. Reese veered toward it and began to climb. It was steep enough that the snow only held to the more horizontal ledges. His feet slid out from under him as he worked his way up the scree, thin pieces of rock causing him to slide back a step with every 2 he took forward. Slinging his rifle across his back, he grabbed at anything that would give him purchase, his hot breath visible in the cold, early morning air.
"Keep moving forward," he heard his dad's voice urging him on. "Always improve your fighting position, son."
His legs burned, and he felt the rocks and ice tearing at his hands. Up he went, continuing his scramble.
"Almost!"
There it was. His sniper's perch beckoned. Sliding into an elevated position above those moving in to kill his team, Reese unslung his rifle and flipped up the scope covers before going prone and setting the flare gun to his right. He was about to find out what they faced. Stock to shoulder, cheek to its rest, body nestled in among the rocks and ice, safety off. Reese reached for the flare gun, cocked it, pointed it skyward over what he estimated was the enemy position, and pulled the trigger. Vasilyevich watched his flanking element approach the enemy's suspected position. They moved in slowly, weapons up, scanning the terrain before them. Even with the advantage of the nods, the ground was treacherous and the Americans were armed.
How had they identified the MON-50s right before they entered the kill zone? They must have a dog with them fucking dogs.
The flanking element would have them in sight any moment now. A popping noise to his left took his attention from the scene below, and a second later his nods erupted in bright white. Reese was on the gun and on the trigger when his first flare illuminated the ground below. He'd been slightly off on his estimation of where the opposing force's base element would be situated, but not by much. Without a laser rangefinder, Reese estimated distance by one of the ways he'd been taught almost 20 years before. He used a map study. Actual distance to target, 550 yards. Altitude, temperature, velocity, bore height, ballistic coefficient of the 300 Win Mag Barnes TTSX. Elevated at a 35-degree incline. 2 mil adjustment for a 39.5-inch drop. Wind approximately 5 miles an hour. Full value, 8.5-inch hold right. Reese made the adjustments in his head and pressed the trigger, sending 180 grains of Barnes triple shock through the spine of the far-left shooter. Quickly throwing the bolt, Reese chambered his second round and let it fly. He aimed at the upper torsos of his targets, the bullet's nose peeling back instantly on contact into a copper petal of death, tearing through the heart and lungs of his second target. A third soldier was struggling to get into a kneeling position, suddenly aware the 2 of his teammates were no longer of the earth.
when Reese's third bullet took him high in the chest.